Welcome is my song.
Love,
my opening.
Talk,
come on.
Radio.
Come on, don't fail me now, computer. Here we go.
Let's get lost in a better place. Pick up the world, travel through time and space. So much to learn, so much to see. A chance to escape reality. Open your mind and your heart. Gain new knowledge, get a fresh new start. They never will bring you there. So let's talk about it when life and on the
air. Hi everyone, this is your host Fran Lewis. This is Literary Viewpoints MJ Network in memory of my sister. And what better way to end the lineup for September than the number one New York Times bestselling author and book. Oh my God. If you haven't read it, where are you? Juror number 3, Nancy Allen, is here, and she wrote this with James Patterson, and I am totally pumped. Good morning. How are you doing? And maybe we'll bring some sunshine rainy day.
Oh, it's cloudy here too, Fran, but it's a bright morning because not only am I talking with you, but in addition, you said those words that I will never grow weary of. Number one, New York Times bestselling, juror number 3. Love it.
I am so excited. I just want you to know that my ophthalmologist and my eye doctor and everyone's wife is buying it, because when I said I was interviewing you, they said, we saw it. I said, well, go get the book. And they're all
glad
so
to hear.
Excited.
Glad to hear.
And then, yeah, well, I have to, you know, I walk into the office and she says, oh, you really interview? I said, just look at my phone. What can I tell you? So, this book was very interesting. It had like two novels in one. How did you do that? Because it's like part one and then part two.
You know, it's kind of actually a hallmark of James Patterson's novels is that there are often multiple plot lines, more than one dastardly deed or crime going on. But in this book, in juror number 3, we have two overlapping plots because Ruby has to handle two very compelling murder cases. And so they are intertwined in a number of ways, as you know, Fran, but they overlap. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, we have the story of two criminal jury trials rather than one.
That's what
and you know, originally, James Patterson conceived Juror Number 3 as a book for his Bookshops line, but I am really proud to tell you that he was so happy with the work that we were doing together and the characters and world we were creating. Mm. He said, oh, this needs to be a hardcover release. And so we expanded the story and expanded the world and created the hardcover of Ruby Bozar, Mississippi defense attorney, and her law practice. So that's kind of how that came about.
I just loved it. And I, you know, I have to say that when I get, you know, certain books which have large print because I can read them, and I got, I read it at the, during, well, I met you at the Fuller Fest, and that's when I started it. Actually,
yes,
I finished it right away. I couldn't put it down.
Oh, love
really
to hear
bad.
That.
Yeah, well, you know, there aren't
love
too many
hear,
that
okay,
are.
Okay, Fran Lewis could not put it down, had to keep turning the pages. That is a gold star in my book, yes.
It was. I couldn't put it down. And lately I've been getting books that I could put down right away. And it's really sad. What can I say? You just never know. But who creates the plot? How did you collaborate to write the plot? And I love this character. You've got to bring her back, really. She is really perfect.
I love that you love Ruby Bozarth, because I do too. But as far as the co-authoring process, you know, a lot of people are curious about that. Mm-hmm. And because I live in the Ozarks, as people who are listening this morning may be able to tell, I am not from either the East Coast or the West Coast. And James Patterson lives in Florida, and you know a lot of people around here. Well, I thought that I must have just traveled to James Patterson's house in Florida and that we sat, I don't know, on his patio and watched the sunset on the Atlantic Ocean as we wrote together and ate hors d'oeuvres. But that isn't really how it works. It's a long-distance relationship. Yes, a collaboration. And yes, we work together, but we don't work together in the same room. You know, one thing that everybody knows about James Patterson, and this was really an education for me, James Patterson will tell anyone that he is an outliner. He is a strong believer that you outline the entire plot chapter by chapter before you ever pick up the pen and write the first page. That was not how I had worked in the past, because I have four novels out in my Ozarks Mystery series. But I was what they call an organic writer, which means you just let the story take you along. And some people call that a pantser, Fran, that you write by the seat of your pants. I had to learn to do it James Patterson's way, since I had this incredible opportunity of working with him. And so he taught me how to be an outliner, because that's how we put it together, and that's the process how we began. So it was really a very valuable opportunity, not only to work with him and have a book released with him, but also to have him teach me to do it just like James Patterson does. And I am lucky indeed.
You are lucky indeed. And I see, you know, as I interview everybody in the whole universe somehow, I take notes because, you know, writing is something that I do, but I don't even come close to what you guys do. And I sort of outline, but sometimes I just sit down and take my notepad on my phone and write. That's how I do my book reviews. It works better. I just put them on my little notes, and then I email them to myself, and it gets done. It's fantastic. So
you know,
I learned from all of you.
I found it's true. And one thing that I did learn from this process, you know, if you are an organic writer or a pantser, which is what I used to be, it's lots easier to start a book. So it's lots easier to get started when you can just pick up the pen and go. But you have a tendency to get stuck. And I don't think I'm the only person who's an author that ever happened to. So it's lots easier to start when you're organic. But when you are an outliner like James Patterson, and now me, it's a whole lot easier to finish the book, because there's no such thing as being stuck in the middle or having that writer's block where, oh, my gosh, I don't know what happens next. Yeah, you do. You know what happens next. Look at the outline. It's right there.
I can imagine. Yeah, I know. He's. I love him. I love his work, and he's just absolutely amazing. And what bothers me is that I sent to Erin McGrath, who's his publicist, not for this one, but for another one, and I was like, where is my books? Why aren't you sending them to the great to me? And I don't know. I just got an email.
You know,
from
I have also worked with Erin. She is just lovely. And and I do know, however, who delivered you. Hand-delivered you one of the earliest copies of Juror Number 3 that was out in the world prior to the release date. Fran and I ran into each other in New York at the process, and I had one copy of Juror Number 3 at that point, and Fran, you'll recall, I gave it to you.
Yes, I do, and I have it autographed, and nobody's getting it, not my cousin or anybody else.
Don't lend that one out. That's for your bookcase.
That was my birthday present, because my birthday was the 9th, and that's all I'll say about that.
There we go.
Yeah, we don't. There's a thing in this word law family. We never talk about how old we are, because it really doesn't matter. What matters is, did you wish me happy birthday? And if you didn't, you don't get a present on yours. That's it.
That's a good
question. We're very funny. Yeah, and the last time somebody sent me an email with my birthday, I just X'd them out of everything. I said, I'm not speaking to you. That's okay, and you're wrong. So, I love Ruby. How did you create Ruby as a novice lawyer and send her straight into the big leagues at a murder case? And no less, the first scene with Darren, oh, my God, that poor guy never knew what hit him. That was really good.
Well, a lot of people have said, why is Ruby so young? And, you know, when I was writing my other books, because my character Elsie is a young lawyer, too, and people have tried to tell me young lawyers can't have major cases. Well, that is not the truth. I graduated from law school at the age of 24. I went straight into criminal law. And, you know, criminal trial practice is a challenge. It's a challenge even for lawyers who are much older and have experience because there's so much at stake. But for a lawyer who is straight out of law school, criminal trial practice is terrifying. So we thought that it heightened the drama to have Ruby not only get this case that was had so much at stake where an innocent man could be found guilty in a capital case, but it heightened the drama to have Ruby be so young and flounder before she got her footing in that case. So we thought that it just upped the odds.
I know, that's like unbelievable. Whoa. So because this girl, Jewel Shore, who we get to know in a sense, is from a prominent family, why did the DA think that it was a slam dunk? And he tried to come up against Ruby. And let me tell you, you don't want to come up against Ruby.
And so in this case, Jewel Shaw is the deceased. And she is a member of the country club set in this small community. And so Jewel Shaw has been found murdered at country club. And the person who found her was Darian. And Darian is the young man. Darian Summers. He was a waiter at the country club. Now, his background is, and of course, he'd grown up poor in the community, but he was a college or a high school football star who went to college on a football scholarship, but then had an injury and was sidelined. And so he's back in town waiting tables at the country club. Now, as it happens in this community, there are additional tensions because Jewel, the deceased, she's white, and Darian's black, and it's set in Mississippi. Now, I want to say we still have class differences in the United States. We do, and it's not just the South. And sometimes law enforcement, sometimes they prefer to protect rich people over poor people. That's not just true in Mississippi. It's true everywhere. But we know that the tension is heightened in the Deep South because there is an inheritance of outdated attitudes regarding race that still exists with certain individuals. Not with everyone, certainly, but there are people who still have those attitudes. And I am a person who lives in rural America. I've lived all my life in the Ozarks. And I will say anyone who claims that racism is a thing of the past is lying because it's still here. So the prosecution in our case, in Ruby's first case, where they have brought a capital murder charge against Darian Summers, the prosecution wants a quick, easy victory because they have one of the town's first daughters, and they have accused this poor young man of color of murdering her. And what better way to get a quick, easy victory than for the prosecutor to have an opponent in the defense attorney whose girl just out of school and is green as grass.
Yeah, well, for him it makes it so much easier because they think it's a slam dunk until they find out that Ruby is anything but a dunk.
But, yeah, Ruby's a junkyard dog. So Ruby is inexperienced, but Ruby has a lot of chutzpah, I think, as they say in the big city.
Yeah. She's me. You see, that's what I love about her. Is that she does?
Oh, I love that.
I'm terrible too. You know, when I was younger, I wasn't like this. I grew up to be, you know, when I want to know something, I do it. And if I have a question, I'm not going to stop until I get the answer. And a lot of people look at me like, you know, that gets. I said, I don't really care. If I want to know something and it's too important, I'm not going to let it go until I find out the answers, no matter what it takes to bother everybody to find out. So, she did something really brazen and bold that I would do. Yes. If I had one. She called her ex-fiancé Lee and his aunt Suzanne, who I love, helped her. How come? She's really cool.
Well,
I
she
like
called Lee. Oh, thank you so much. So Ruby calls her ex-fiance, and Ruby, and she grew up poor, we know. Ruby, when she was in law school, she became engaged to one of the first sons of Mississippi, this very elegant young man, Lee Green. And so Lee Green and she have split because he's a cheater and he wasn't anything that Ruby needed in her life. And she never thought she'd call him again, but she did. When you are going into a jury trial, Fran, your client, particularly if your client is a criminal defendant, they need to be dressed in a suit and tie because it affects how the jury perceives them. So Ruby says to Darian that he's got to wear a suit and tie to court, and he said, I don't have one. So she is obsessed with finding one for him, and the one person she knows who is a clothes horse who would have a suit and tie easily at his disposal is her old ex-fiance, Lee Green. So she swallows her pride and calls him on the phone and says, would you just give me a cast off you don't wear anymore? And he is such a snooty fella that he won't, but he does pass her off to his Aunt Suzanne. And he says, what you ought to do is call my Aunt Suzanne. And she said, if you won't help me, why would your aunt help me? And he says, because she's the black sheep of the family and she has a taste for trash. So Ruby does get in touch with his aunt, who is a scrappy trial attorney, also in Mississippi in the neighboring county, a woman in her 50s. And Aunt Suzanne is glad to help Ruby because it turns out Suzanne is the black sheep of the Green family because she is a card-carrying member of the ACLU, and in her days, she was a bra-burning feminist who went to law school when everybody else was going to finishing school in Mississippi. So Suzanne does not only give Ruby a suit for Darian to wear to court, but she starts giving her some really good advice.
She's somebody that I could probably love to talk to for other reasons, too. She sounds interesting.
Yes, indeedy.
Yeah, I know.
And so, Suzanne,
how does
she realizes during the conversation that Ruby doesn't have a clue what she's doing, and so she starts to mentor her and to guide her in the case preparation.
Well, everybody needs somebody like that to guide them.
Yeah.
And everybody needs somebody to help somebody. That's my problem. This is very true. Yeah, you do. And, you know, my mother always said, it doesn't matter what you're doing. If someone needs your help to do something, then stop what you're doing and help them. And that would get me in trouble.
Extremely good,
Mom. It got me in trouble a lot because I was hit. I have 17 term papers. She said, well, it doesn't really matter what you have. You need to help your cousins right there. Okay, but they forgot that I helped them. Oh, well.
Oh, so, gracious sakes.
I don't care.
So, Suzanne,
so, yeah,
I'm glad you liked her.
I liked her a lot. I really hope that you guys are going to bring her back, bring both of them back, because Ruby's got a lot more to do. So how does Ruby takes to her, and she presents her motions, and Lafayette is shocked, isn't he? So how did you use your legal expertise to come into this? Because there's definitely hilarious moments here, seriously.
Well, and so, as you said, so Ruby doesn't know what she's doing, and Suzanne gives her some advice, and Suzanne says you have got to get into court because she needs to take control of the discovery process. And so Ruby, very grateful for Suzanne's assistance, Suzanne tells her what she needs to do, the procedural steps to get information of the case. Now, I am a Missouri lawyer, and one thing that I know is a lot of what happens in court is really boring and very long. But there are a few things that happen in court that are fascinating and interesting and dramatic. I leave out all the boring things. I only have courtroom scenes that are really going to grab the attention of the reader. And so I did think we accomplished that when Ruby goes into court, where she has been absolutely knocked down and bottom rung, and she goes into court because of Suzanne's advice, and she scores her first victory. Now, you know, I'm a Missouri lawyer. I've never practiced in Mississippi, and the book is set in Mississippi. There are a great many similarities between Mississippi law and Missouri law in the criminal area, but there are some differences. But I have not only practiced law, I've also taught law at the university level. So I just took care to research Mississippi criminal law and make sure that I was getting it right. So,
well, you know what? I learned a lot. I'm learning a lot for other reasons. So what evidence does a defense attorney need to get the prosecution, and to, how did she learn what else she needed? Because she really had to work really hard at this.
In a criminal case, the prosecution has to give discovery to the defense. The prosecution essentially has to turn over their case file to the defense attorney so the defense attorney can prepare for trial and defend against the charge. Now, in this case, Lafayette gives Ruby. Lafayette is the DA in Mississippi that Ruby's going up against. And Lafayette, he gives her the paper file, but he doesn't want to let Ruby go into the evidence room at the police department and dig around mm-hmm. in the physical exhibits and the physical evidence, which Suzanne tells Ruby she absolutely has to do. So that is how Suzanne gives her first assistance. In addition to the suit, is she tells her the steps she needs to accomplish that. Ruby has got to get in there and examine the physical evidence. And we know that when she does, she finds things that are very valuable indeed.
Yeah, well, she does, and I sense the way she goes around about it is very clever. Hold on, let me get. So, how does she? They tell us about the jury selection, and why the black jurors were dismissed, which bothered me, and the judge's reasons. This judge, Judge Bailey, not good. And he
Judge Bailey,
like on the
we
other
don't
side.
Find a very likable fellow. So,
no, he wasn't very likable
at all.
You,
no, I've tried a lot of jury cases, all criminal. And during jury selection, I told you that Missouri law and Mississippi law are different mm-hmm. in some ways. And one way that I discovered they're different is during the jury selection process. When I was doing my legal research, I discovered that in jury trials, Mississippi has a literacy requirement for people to serve on a jury. This raised a flag for me, Fran. I don't know for certain that they devised this literary requirement for jury service. I don't know for certain that they intended it to interfere with the racial component of the jury, but it could give a trial judge who is wrong-minded the power to impact the makeup of the jury panel. And so Ruby is very surprised when it's time to start we call it voir dire, the jury selection process.
Mm-hmm.
And the first thing that Judge Bailey does, he starts dismissing a bunch of people from the jury panel, many who are black. And she says, "What are you doing?" And he says, "Oh, I have given them literacy forms to fill out, and I am dismissing the people whose literacy skills, I believe, are not sophisticated enough to serve." Ruby has a black client in Mississippi charged with the murder of a white socialite, and she ends up with a jury panel that is almost all white. And that is not what the defense attorney would want in that case.
No, they wouldn't.
You know, no. Now, more about jury selection. You know, both sides are entitled to a jury that's fair and impartial and is just going to decide the case on the evidence alone. So during jury selection, both sides get to ask prospective jurors a bunch of questions because you have to see whether these people have any bias against one side
mm-hmm.
or another, or have they already made their mind up, or do they have some kind of attitudes that would cause them not to be fair and impartial. And if their answers show that somebody's biased, well, you can get rid of that person. You can strike that prospective juror from the panel, and you can either strike them, try and get the judge to strike them for cause, If a judge won't do that, then the both attorneys have the opportunity to use peremptory challenges, where then the attorneys themselves can get rid of them.
No, I know. You know, it's funny. Before I retired from teaching, they called me to Bronx Court. It was really funny. It was an accident case, and I was listening to them talk, and the lawyers from both sides were asking questions, and then I accidentally said, there's something, out loud, I didn't realize it, I bet they're all in it together. The cab, the ambulance driver, the brother-in-law, the sister-in-law that were together in the car, I said, I bet they're in it together, at which point the lawyers from both sides looked at me and said, we need to talk to you outside. And I said, there's something strange about what you said, because I have a funny feeling that why would the person's sister-in-law sue her brother-in-law, who's the same car? I said, I bet they're going to share the money, at which point they told me I was too smart to be on the jury.
I think at that point they would say, ma'am, you are excused.
Yeah, they looked at me and they said, did you ever decide to maybe become a lawyer? I said, I thought about it, but, you know, I work with kids with learning disabilities and reading, and I didn't get excused for 2 more days, and each of the panel said I was too smart. They said I saw too much into what they were doing, and they didn't want anybody that bright on the jury. Oh, well, what can I tell you?
Not only that, but a person who is articulate and bright and is willing to speak up can influence
yeah.
the other jurors back in the jury room
yeah.
during deliberations. So that's something they had an eye out for as well, I bet, Fran.
Yeah, they didn't want me there, which is perfectly okay. So we have juror number 3. What made
Aha,
you...
Aha, juror number 3, yes.
Yeah, there was something right away that told me, uh-oh. And what happens when the trial thought that unnerves her about him? We don't want to say too much,
there's
but
some quality.
Oh my God, he was
and you
really
know,
scary.
There, we know about Ruby. We find out pretty quick because Ruby did
yeah.
not grow up in any kind of sophisticated environment, but Ruby has great gut instincts because she's had to rely on her wits all her life. So Ruby, there is something about juror number 3 that Ruby didn't like. That is off-putting about him. And she has seen him in the community before, we know, because she goes to Shorty's Diner, and he goes there because there's mm-hmm. not a million places to eat. And there's just something about this guy. And so during the jury selection process, Ruby gets to ask a number of questions to see if anyone is prejudiced against a client. And one thing she asks is, this happened at the country club. Is anyone on this jury panel a member of the country club, or have you ever eaten there? Because that'd be something she needs to know. Well, a lot of people raise their hands. A lot of them, when she asks further questions, say, yeah, I think it would affect my decision-making as a juror. Yeah, because I'm a member, I really don't think I could be impartial. And so they get struck off the panel. Juror number 3 raises his hand, and he says, I have eaten there. And she asks all the follow-up questions about impartiality, but he gives all the right responses. It will not affect my impartiality. I will base my verdict entirely on the evidence. I have no bias at all. And so he didn't get struck because he says everything right. But even though he says everything right, there's something about him that bugs her. Now, I told you that if you can't get him struck for cause, then you can use your peremptory challenges and get rid of that person, and they won't serve on the jury. But when she and Lafayette, the prosecutor, go up to the bench to do strikes for cause, it's Lafayette who asks for juror number 3 to be struck from the jury panel. And she's going, oh my gosh, I thought I didn't want him, but the prosecutor doesn't want him. And one thing in trial practice, if a juror is bad for one side, it's good for another. Mm-hmm. So, and the judge overrules the request to strike juror number 3 for cause because he said everything right about impartiality. And so he's on the panel. Ruby could get rid of him, but it really is true. She's thinking, well, the prosecutor doesn't want him, so if the prosecutor thinks he's bad for the prosecution, then we got to keep him because that must mean he's good for the defense. So Ruby and Darian do not strike juror number three, and he is on the jury for the murder case. And that's why she left him on, even though she doesn't like him for some reason that she can't even put her finger on.
Oh, we're not going to tell you what she does, but Suzanne tells her to keep quiet. Throughout both trials, she says, don't say anything and keep it quiet. Why is that?
Suzanne is an experienced litigator. And Suzanne knows that. And also, I think we reveal, Suzanne just loves to go to casinos. She's also a gambler. But Suzanne knows that sometimes you got to keep a card up your sleeve. So when Ruby learns something very shocking about one of the jurors that would entitle her to an immediate mistrial, she calls Suzanne, and Suzanne says, do nothing. Do nothing. You're going to sit on that. She said, because if you go ahead and reveal that now, the best you can hope for is a mistrial, and then you're going to have to start all over again, and you still don't have a resolution that's good for your client. But, and if you continue with this trial, he may be acquitted. And then, if he is not acquitted, then you play that card, and it is absolutely your basis for new trial or for a successful appeal. So, Suzanne is a person who knows the tricks of the trade, and so she gives very good advice to Ruby in that regard.
I like Suzanne. I think everybody needs a Suzanne in her life, seriously.
Everyone does. You know, she's a composite character because a lot of people think she sounds like me, but I have a sister. I've got a sister who is generally described as the meanest trial attorney in Southwest Missouri. And unlike me, because I'm about 5'8", my sister is 6 feet tall. And there's a whole lot of my big sister in Aunt Suzanne.
Well, I'll tell you what, I could use both of you, but I can't tell you why on the air. Seriously.
Okay.
Seriously. I may private message you that later, but yeah, seriously, I'm learning a lot. So we have the end of this first one, and then we meet Monet was the girlfriend of Lee's friend. She was in court also. So tell us about Lee's parents and why he was the next person on trial. Because we're not going to say what happened.
You know, the cases are kind of reversals, because in the first trial, Ruby defends a poor man against the power class because a poor young man who's a waiter is accused of killing a girl in the country club set. In the second case, Ruby defends the country club set, her ex-fiancé Lee Green, against the charge that he has murdered a young prostitute who happens to be black in the story, Monet. So he encountered Monet because Lee Green had an old frat brother who's a friend of his in Vicksburg. And when he was in Vicksburg, he got together with the old frat brother, and they went out, and one thing led to another. Next thing we know, there's a prostitute in the room, and then Lee Green wakes up the next morning, and the prostitute is dead in bed with him. And they accuse him of the murder of the prostitute through intoxication, through the roofie drug, because it can, with alcohol, be fatal. And they accuse him of the murder. And the problem with representing Lee Green in that case is he can't remember a single thing that happened. So that's the second case. And so they're kind of reversals. And the prostitute, Monet, was hired, according to Lee, that he tells Ruby that Monet was hired by this old frat brother, Carrie. And Carrie says, yeah, I hired that prostitute because I know just what Lee likes. And we do know that Lee's a womanizer because that's the reason that Ruby broke up with him in the first place. So now Ruby's got another trial, And there's just as much at stake this time, except he's also the nephew of her mentor and friend, Suzanne Green, as well as her ex-fiancé. And now she's got to defend him against this murder charge. And he's a very educated, smart fella, but he's not very helpful because he doesn't remember anything.
Well, there's a reason, but we won't say why. So
yeah,
we've got two judges, and I hated them both. And they both had the similarities and differences. So which judge did you like better? Because I don't like either one of them.
You know, I think because, as you say, because the first one is Judge Baylor, and Judge Baylor is the old homeboy in Rosedale, where she lives, and he is already buddies and pals with the prosecutor, which you'll find is not that unusual in the practice of law, especially in small-town communities. And so that is the first judge. And also, the first judge treats, wouldn't you agree that he treats Ruby with a lack of respect?
Yes.
Initially, is not respectful of her. Anyway, in the second trial, we have the out-of-town judge, and this is Judge Ashley, who comes from Vicksburg to Rosedale to try the case on a change of venue. Now, here again, the judge is also an associate and friends with the prosecutor, but we don't see quite as much. We don't see as much favoritism in that case. He's more professional, except for the fact that Judge Ashley is deaf as a post and refuses to wear his hearing aid in court. Now, I tell you, they say justice should be blind, and that's true indeed. But justice, when it's deaf, can create problems for the attorneys who are trying the case.
I know. So we have, in both cases, how did the victim's cell phones help out? And is that admissible to use, you know, cell phone pictures and stuff? I'm asking for a reason. What happens if you have a case, whatever it is, and you find out that people are snapshotting your Facebook wall? I mean, I imagine they could have done this in this case, too, if there was Facebook, and you don't know about it. Is that legal?
You know, there, technology is advancing so much faster than the law that the law is having a lot of trouble keeping up with it. Now, and I would say this is, aside from the book, in the state of Missouri, we had a case where there was an individual who was using cell phone, allegedly, to create revenge porn. We didn't have a statute in our criminal code to cover it because our criminal code has not kept up with the advances made in technology and cell phones. So the law, they always used to say, oh, the law grinds very slow, but it grinds very fine indeed. The law's got to move faster. We have not kept up with technology, and so sometimes there are not even answers yet. There's not even answers to what's admissible or what is a crime or the extent to which advances in technology fit into places in federal and state criminal law. So honest to goodness, that is the truth. Now, in this case, Jewel Shaw, the deceased, in the first case where the young football player waiter has been charged with her murder, the prosecution is using images that were on her cell phone in order to as evidence in order to convict Darian, and they are images of Darian and Jewel Shaw having sex because they had an intimate relationship. And so because the prosecution is using those images, then that would entitle Ruby as a defense attorney to use them as well. They've opened the door. So Ruby also finds images on the phone. Well, first of all, one thing Ruby points out with the images is this was a consensual relationship because a picture is worth a thousand words. Mm-hmm. So it's clear that Jewel was happy with the sexual relationship, and Ruby points that out. But also, it's clear from the images on Jewel Shaw's cell phone that Jewel Shaw was a wild child, and she had a whole lot of sexual relationships. Now, We are in an era where it has become unacceptable, as it should, for people to try to shame women on the basis of sexual activity that men have always been able to enjoy.
Mm-hmm.
And Ruby and Suzanne go into that because Suzanne said, you've got to get on that phone. And she's probably got a lot of other lovers, and you are going to use that as a smokescreen, because you've got to use those images to combat this notion that he's a terrible person and that she was the wonderful, perfect young woman. And Ruby says, that's slut-shaming, and I don't believe in it. But old Suzanne says, you know, Jewel Shaw is dead, and you can't hurt her feelings. But your client could end up dead if you don't use mm-hmm. every tool at your disposal. So that's what they went ahead and Ruby utilized that. Now, in addition, in the second trial, there is a social media website where when Ruby finally stumbles onto it because she's starting to figure things out, there's a social media website where she finds out very unexpected information about the relationship between the deceased, young Monet, the prostitute, and one of the witnesses. And when she finds that out, then that sends her on more of an investigation, which leads to a very exciting part of the book, which I don't want to reveal because I want everyone to be so surprised.
Well, before I
But you're
out,
right.
I don't know.
Oh, go
I
ahead.
Know. Tuesday, I'm going to do something very different. Trinity House Entertainment Inc. Rachel and Michael will be here. They created the opening for my show, and we're going to talk about their mission, their music, and how when you listen to their music, you feel so much better. And they're going to sing their new song, It's Never Too Late to Forgive. It's fantastic. On the 4th, I'm going to do something really different. I'm going to have a show on multiple sclerosis. And the person is, Trish Stevens, wants to share her story. On the 8th, someone that you know, Shannon Kirk, will be here with In the Vines. And on the 10th, this is going to be probably seriously different. Three authors, Charles Salzberg, Ross Clavin, and Tim O'Mara, Three Strikes. On the 15th, we have Napa Noir, and on the 17th, Howard Shapiro graphic novel. This is the first, Queen of Kenosha. And on the 22nd, Criminal Minds. And on the 25th, someone you know, Carla Negus, is going to be here with Imposter's Law. And what better way to end October than with someone else we both know, Bruce Coffin, Beyond the Truth. Could you ask for better? No. And that is exciting.
I love Bruce Coffin. Very good.
I love his book, and he's so nice. And because of him, the next day, on this first, I'm interviewing James Heyman, Fatal Obsession, because Fran walked up to him and said, how come I didn't read your book? Yes, this is the second interview
James is
doing with me.
James Heyman's a friend of mine, too.
Well,
this
you
is
see,
almost like
I
a
get
club.
All...
I wish we were all just together in the same room.
Well, I may decide to have you all together on the same panel because I'm doing a panel in December, which is kind of wild because Carla Negus is going to do it with two other people. We're going to talk about how do you pick your name for your character and how do you pick their occupation, something that authors have trouble with.
That is interesting. And do you know it's more complex than you can imagine, especially when you're writing a book a year? Oh, you can run out of names. Woo!
And then I'm going to do another one also. And how do you decide how your character drives the plot? And if your character could decide the plot, how would your character decide that? I've got a whole bunch of ideas on my little cell phone over here. You never know when I'm going to do something. Yeah, well, you know, you see, this is what happens when you're a reading specialist and you come up with questions that nobody else asks. So we've got some deputies on both cases that are linked. And tell us a little about the deputies. I don't want to mention anybody's names. We have about 10 minutes.
All right.
One more.
There are two deputies that are crucial in these stories. And we could just say there was a young deputy and an older deputy. Now, we meet the young deputy, actually, we meet him in the first jury trial because he is the one that oversees Ruby in the evidence room. But then he and his partner appear in the second case. And as I told you, we have more than one murder and more than one dastardly deed in the book Jury Number 3, and it happens that Ruby's star witness, one of the first things that shakes her in the Lee Green murder trial, is her star witness, who is a Vicksburg vice cop, an undercover detective, who was supposed to be the one who was going to make her case and save the day. He's murdered on the first day of trial, and so she has lost her star witness. But not only that, as she is in court, The young deputy who is assisting the bailiff because they need more security for a capital murder case, the sheriff comes in and arrests him for the murder of the vice detective. Now, the older partner is present at the time and is devastated, he says, for his young partner and his young partner, and just feels like he's really got to look out for him and got to be a part of the process because the young man comes to Suzanne for assistance and aid. I will tell you, Ruby kind of wonders whether he's rooting for the young deputy or whether this guy is working with the sheriff. So that's another thing that has Ruby troubled during this process.
Well, Lee is really a chauvinist. Seriously. And he thinks
and arrogant.
Yes. The arrogant chauvinist, you know what. And I've met a lot of people like that through my years of dating people that I dumped. Seriously. I don't have patience for that. And I really don't feel that anybody that thinks they're better than anyone should be in my face. And, yeah, true story. I mean, went out with somebody once, and he said, you know, I'm in a higher class than you. I said, really? Are you taller than me? I didn't know that. You in a higher number? You have higher grades than I do? He said, you know, I could take you on my yacht and my plane and, you know, I'll show you how everything is. I said, oh, I can hang up on you, which I did.
Very good.
I don't like people like that. And I said, and you don't know what's in my bank account. I said, and it's none of your business. So people like that get me annoyed. So why does Lee show his true colors to Ruby? And at the end, why does he think he's so important in demand and the fact that, you know, what she does is priceless, seriously. Girl knows what not to do.
And Lee thinks that because he was raised that way from the cradle, because he is the only son of this prominent family. He is old money, old family Mississippi. And so he was raised from the day he was born to believe that he was all that. So he thinks he is. And one thing that I enjoyed about this and that I would say James Patterson also loved about our story we worked on together was the contrast between Ruby and Lee. Because Ruby, she was the daughter of a single mother. Her mother was a cleaning lady who cleaned hotel rooms in small town hotels. Ruby doesn't know her dad is because she was the product of a one-night stand at a country music concert. And then we have Lee, who is the prince of Mississippi. And you know, of course, I'm rooting for Ruby and not for Lee because that's true in all the books I write because it's true in my life. You know, I was an English major. And they had us study in one class. It was a study of American authors of a certain period. And I love John Steinbeck. John Steinbeck is my favorite American author. But they were always wanting to push F. Scott Fitzgerald at us. Now, F. Scott Fitzgerald was a good storyteller, but he wanted to write about rich people, entitled people. I love John Steinbeck because Steinbeck believes, as I do, in the innate nobility of the working poor and the working class. And I believe that's true. I've seen it all my life. So anyway, I try to embody that in Ruby. And so I guess with Ruby and Lee, we got John Steinbeck versus F. Scott Fitzgerald. And in my book, Steinbeck always wins. So anyway, I did like to make that contrast. And so that was fun to do. But of course Lee thought she'd take him back because in Lee's mind there wouldn't be any question because he thinks he's better than she is.
I don't like people like that. And, you know, it's funny, my dad was a dry cleaner. He owned a dry cleaning store. And I worked in the store and before I started to teach. And you know what? It was just fine. He did very well like that. And my grandfather came to America and he sold apples on a street corner until he bought 5 cleaning stores. So, you know, people sort of look down on you when your parents, you know, are not college educated. But my father would have been college educated if my grandfather didn't die and my grandmother didn't make him sell mattresses, whatever, on the black market. When he died, he had to support the family. So there's something very important before we end that's important. Date rape. What is something that young people need to know? Because I try to explain it to my nieces, too, that if you're going out and you leave your drink, throw it away and get another one. Because you never know what someone's going to put. So what did they learn about that? Because that's important.
And in the murder cases in this book, as we pointed out, there are 2 young women who were victimized. And both Jewel and Monet were taking intoxicants when they were murdered. And another thing that is, so we know young women can be victimized. We hear it on the news every night. And this is true, and it was true in my practice as a prosecutor, and it's still true today. This is particularly true. They are more vulnerable when they are consuming intoxicants. Now, every young adult wants to get to have a cocktail. There's nothing the matter with that. But I can tell you, I would tell any young woman, and I've got a college-age daughter, you don't let anyone give you a drink at a party unless it is someone you know very well and trust. Nobody else gets to make your cocktail. And you have a drink and you walk away from it, you don't come back and pick it up. Because we've all heard of roofies. They're really out there. It's not even – this isn't just a matter of fiction. This isn't just something that people put in made-up stories. It's happening every day, and our young women are the most vulnerable to it and also are the most likely to be in parties or bars where strangers would like to take advantage of them. And it's sad but true. I have a 22-year-old daughter because I had a baby at 40. So, I mean, I'm old as can be. But I'm only once, and don't let anybody you don't know make you a drink. Make your own drink if you got to have one. So that's my advice to her. But it is. It's not just fairy tales. Those dangers are out there.
That is so true. But Ruby learned a lot about herself. And at the end, this was really very striking because not very many people would take a Coach bag and put it in Goodwill. I would.
Did you like that? I'm so glad.
Yes, because you know what? When my mom died, she had home health aides. And I had to decide whether I was going to put it in Goodwill, but I gave it all to them. I kept some of the clothes, and then she had 7 home health aides. And I said, you've been helping me keep my mom alive. So that was the Goodwill. I gave it all to them, everything. And whatever else I didn't give, my brother took everything else. I didn't take very much of anything. And I didn't, you know, my mom was like a force to be reckoned with. But I kept her out of a nursing home. That was why I wrote A Daughter's Promise. And I should say I was very honored on the 14th of September. For the first time, I was interviewed on live radio, 98.1, Mike Pomp, open mic, to talk about my book. And I was really proud of myself because it was a half an hour, not 10 minutes, and I didn't get nervous. It was great.
Oh, that's wonderful.
So how did you create that scene? I clapped. When she put it in Goodwill, I said, and she didn't want it. I said, you know what? That says a lot about Ruby. And are you bringing her back? Because she needs to come back. Seriously.
I'm dying for her to come back. And Suzanne, too. But when we meet Ruby, Ruby is in court wearing a Goodwill suit. She had to buy a suit secondhand because that's how poor she is out of law school. But there's one item of value she has. She's got one shiny new thing. She has a Coach briefcase that was a gift, and the only reason she's got a Coach briefcase is because her rich boyfriend gave it to her as a Christmas gift. So she has a shiny Coach briefcase, but everything else about Ruby is secondhand rose. And so she's got that Coach briefcase because she threw his engagement ring in his face after he cheated on her, but she hung on to that Coach briefcase because she thought, my gosh, I got to be practical. At the end, Ruby is putting together a box to take to Goodwill. And the last thing Ruby does in our story is she takes that Coach briefcase and she empties it out and she tosses it on top of the Goodwill box and heads out of her office because she thinks it's going to be a good day at Goodwill and it's a good day for me. And I did want that to be symbolic. Ruby has come into her own. She believes in herself, and you know what our mothers always said, to thine own self be true. And I thought that illustrated that Ruby had come to that point by throwing that Coach bag away.
I agree, because I don't think the quality of something makes you. You know, it's funny, somebody asked me the other day, yesterday, where I got my sneakers. And anybody that knows me knows that I'm not, you know, the usual person. I wear things that are totally outlandish. And I have these really crazy colored sneakers in different colors that I got. And the lady looked at me in the elevator and she said, Nordstrom's, Saks, or Bonwit Teller. I said, Payless. She looked at me.
There you go. That's a
Nancy, it was hilarious. And she said to me, excuse me? I said, Payless. She said, you're not serious. I said, not only am I serious, but I got them in the kids' department because I wear a size 3, and they were $15 back to school. And she just looked at me, and I said,
fabulous.
You two could have the same pair. I said, as a matter of fact, if you come inside, I'll show you my second pair that I got, which is black with silver sparkles on it. And I intend to go back because they have some kids' boots that'll fit me just fine. And she just looked at me and said, you're serious? I said, excuse me? Yep. I thought it was hilarious.
I love that story. Fran, I love it. Because I'm a pretty good-natured soul, but if there is one thing in the world I cannot stand, it's a snob. And anytime you encounter a snob in any book I've had anything to do with, it's a villainous type character. So,
yeah, I grew up with a lot of snobs.
I love
your
story.
Yeah. It's funny because some of the people in my family said, where do you shop? I go, well, it's not Nordstrom's or Nordstrom's Rack. I said, it's Kmart and Target and Marshall's. And they just looked at me and go, you know what? And I walk out. Everybody thinks they don't know where I shop because I look nice. Who cares? So what's next for you? Are you bringing back Elise anytime soon?
Well, you know, I have really throughout all of 2017 and into 2018, we were readying not only Juror Number 3, which stars Ruby Bozarth, but also I was finalizing the fourth book in the Ozarks Mystery Series, which stars Elsie Arnold. And so book 4, A Wolf in the Woods, came out in 2018, and so did Juror Number 3. And I will tell you, I've been catching my breath for a little while. In 2017, I took one day off all year, and it was December 25th, and it wasn't like a holiday for me because I had to bake a ham. So I have been taking a little easy and enjoying the release of these two books, but I'm ready to get back on it, and we're just going to see what happens next.
I can't wait to see what happens
next. Me either.
Because seriously, I need to know what Elise is going to do, but I really hope that James, you know, decides to definitely bring her back, because this is a really solid character. And I'm going to email Erin and say, why aren't you sending me more of your books? And which is the publicist? I'm trying to find her on my phone that I'm supposed to send for the James Patterson one. That's where I was going to get one by the time the book came out, with my 5 stars on the 10th. That was my present to myself.
And I think that's Erin. I think you've got the right name.
Erin McGrath? I'm going to find out. Because
yes.
She said, whoever it was said, the one that you work with for this one, I'm going to send to her, and I'm going to yell. Because seriously, I want a copy of that book. I'll say, Erin,
well,
where's my copy of my whatever? And yeah. I will in a couple of minutes.
Well,
I thought it was somebody else.
She's dull.
I bet you
she'll be right on it.
I'm going to tell her, and I'm going to tell you, send me some more James Patterson, because they're like so quick and easy to read. But for those of you that want to know what I've read recently, just about everything, Juror Number 3, of course, is phenomenal. And Button Man by Andrew Gross was fantastic. unbelievable. December 4th, A Wrong Light by Matt Coyle. We're going to do that one. And this was hilarious. You love this. D.P. Lyle, Doug, was on Facebook, and he says, oh, my new book, Sunshine State, is coming out. I go, well, guess who's got a copy that just came? He said, I don't have one. I said, but I do. And Dick Belsky's new book is coming out, and he's coming on May 2nd. He says, you have a copy of it? I go, it's in my to-read pile. Don't worry about it. I got you covered. I've got a whole bunch. But then when I just started was Jeffrey Archer, Heads You Win, Tails You Lose. Oh, my God. There's one thing about doing what I do is that I don't have to pay for books ever, and I'm never without some 10,000 books to read. What can I say? So I will let you know when I'm doing my next panel show. There's like 5 people on the one in December: Dick Belsky, Carla Negus, Marilyn Levinson, Alan Topol, and Marcia Casper Cook, all in different genres, all over the place. So this should be interesting, and I'm going to do one in January. Where is my phone? And I'm going to do probably one on how do your characters drive your plot, and how does where you place them, why do you change? Some of the authors are, you know, taking plots where there's a lot of different settings, and in your case, I think this would really work with you. How do you use your real-life experience in your novels? And do your main characters, any of your characters, have the same as you? And do you research or have consultants with special resources that no one else would have, like me? So I was thinking of you and maybe T.J. O'Connor and maybe Brian Coffin and maybe one other, maybe John. Oh, yeah, John Land decided he was going to join. He's going to join the fun, too. I can't, you know, what can I say? So that would be interesting. And so before we end, and we're over the hour, but that's okay. If Ruby could say something, what would you tell everybody? You want to come back, Ruby?
I think Ruby would say, follow your gut, because that's what she does.
And I want to thank you so much. This is so much fun. I'll tell you, this is great. It'll be brightening
my
day.
This was such fun.
It is, and the rain is still coming down, but that's okay. That's okay, because Fran has enough books to read.
It was just like a ray of sunshine in here. And Fran, it's always such a pleasure to see you. Well, I guess I was seeing you in my mind while getting to have a conversation with you. So it was fun for me. Thank you for inviting me.
Thank you so much, and I hope I get invited to the Thriller Fest again. And I was one of those people that stood online to get George Martin's autograph because my niece who's going to nursing school decided that her aunt could do her a favor and get her the book, and I did. Only because Danny is doing so well in nursing school did I decide I would stand online for 45 minutes and get her the autograph.
Yeah, Fran, you're a good aunt because I saw that
one. I try so hard. Someday I'll get, you know, really get appreciated here. But thank you so much, everybody. The sun's not coming out till Thursday. It's going to rain tomorrow, but it's a sunny day. And if you get yourself a lot of copies of Dune number 3, it'll keep you busy. And just think about this. Hanukkah's coming, Christmas is coming, and Thanksgiving's coming, and people like presents all the time. And Halloween is coming. There's always a reason to buy a book, seriously. So everybody have a nice day. And thanks, Nancy, and bye.
Bye-bye.